2 Corinthians chapter 12 is where we're going to be this morning. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. We'll get there in just a moment. But first, can I ask, has anybody met anyone who takes pride in just the weirdest thing? Like you meet somebody and they brag about something that you think, I think you should be embarrassed of that. Like, why are you bragging about that, you know? Maybe, okay, this is a common one for teens and for college students. So maybe you've been part of this group or you've heard this group. And one person, you know, they'll be working or they'll be talking together, and one person will yawn and say, oh, I can't hang out for much longer, guys. I only got 6 hours of sleep, you know? And somebody else will be like, 6 hours? That's a lot. I only got 5 hours. You know, somebody else will say, 5 hours? Psh, that's nothing. I only got 3 hours. You know, you got the guy in the corner who's never yawned, never rubs his eyes. He's always holding an energy can, energy drink can. He goes, what? You guys sleep? You know? Like, why are you bragging about trashing your body? Go to sleep, for Pete's sake, you know? Or maybe, okay, I've been part of a conversation at work before where people start bragging about wasting money. I will never understand this. So it goes from one person's talking about how much money they waste a week, a month, a year on energy drinks, and eventually the conversation goes and goes until somebody's bragging about losing $20,000 on a sailing boat. Like, why are you saying like it's a good thing? I don't understand it. When I was a kid, I'll give one more. When I was a kid, I went to an amusement park, and there was a roller coaster I enjoyed so much, it made me scream like a girl. And so I wanted to get everyone to ride this roller coaster because it was so amazing. And so I went up to everyone that I knew. I was just a kid, and I was with the teen group, and I wanted them to ride it and enjoy it. So I would go up to all the teens, and I would say, you have to ride this. You have to ride this. It made me scream like a girl. And I said that to everybody. And eventually my dad pulled me aside, and he's like, hey, maybe don't brag about that, all right? And so sometimes the point I'm trying to make is that we can take pride in things that maybe we shouldn't take pride in. And that's how Paul starts here in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, except he's not even talking about foolish things. He's talking about things that we maybe should strive for. Let me just read verse 1, and we'll talk a little bit here. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 1, he says, it is not expedient for me, doubtless, to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. Then he goes on to list some of these visions and the things that he saw and the languages that he heard and the different experiences that he had. And he goes on to say again, I will not glory. You see, these things are things that we strive after as Christians, the experiences, the revelations, the things that maybe would mark a good Christian, that would mark an apostle. And yet he says, these are things that I would not glory in. It reminds me of that passage in Philippians, I believe it's Philippians 3, verses 4 through 6, where Paul lists out every qualification that he had, where he was born, his upbringing, all of it, and he says, all these things I count but loss. So as we're getting into this passage here in 2 Corinthians 12, my first question to you is, are you glorying in things that you shouldn't be glorying in? If we can just look at what Paul said, maybe we can make some application for ourselves. Are we tempted maybe to glory in our spiritual heritage? Maybe you have several generations worth of grandfathers and great-grandfathers that were saved, and you think, yeah, well, I come from good stock, you know? Maybe your some relative was a deacon or a deaconess. You know, you talk to people in Shelby, and I think there's some churches that just promote all the women to deaconess. Because it seems like every house you knock on, they're like, oh yeah, I have a female relative that's a deaconess. I don't know. But if you're proud of your spiritual heritage, why? What's that got for you? Maybe you don't pride yourself that way, but you were raised in a Christian home. And so you kind of, you know what's going on. You have the lingo down, and it can cause you to become self-sufficient. And that can lead you to become prideful. And maybe you're glorying in your spiritual heritage. You know, I had, I won't say quite friend, maybe in between acquaintance and friend. He's a buddy of mine. And he was linked to a rather large institution. And he meant it as a joke. But, you know, what he said was, we were in some conversation, and his parents were on staff at this institution. And he said, well, you know, we're basically royalty at that institution. Like, are you kidding me? But you just said that out loud. And he was doing it for laughs. But I think if we're not careful, maybe he was relying on that spiritual heritage a little bit. So don't look at him. Look at yourself. Do you take pride in something in your family or in your past or in your upbringing that would make you say, hey, I've got this Christian life thing figured out. I'm set. I'm good. I've got that spiritual heritage. Paul goes on to talk about his moral uprightness and his zeal. How many rule followers do we have in here? Like, you are a rule follower. Wow, three of you. Okay, no. Everyone's turned around to look, well, what staff members are here to tattle on? No, he's saying he was a rule follower to the T. Some of you are not just rule followers, you help other people follow rules, right? That's your kind of zeal. And I'm joking, but it's true. Sometimes we can look at the rule book, we can study it, or we can look at the standards that we've set, not even in college, don't worry about that. We can look at the standards that we've set, even the standards that God has led us to, and we can begin to say, hey, look at my zeal, look at my drive, look at my dedication, look at all these things that I do that other people don't do. And we can begin to become prideful and self-assured in our moral uprightness, in our zeal, maybe even in our helping other people to get their standards straightened out. What about then our spiritual accomplishments? That's what we're seeing here in chapter 12 of 2 Corinthians. Paul had experienced these different things. Maybe you and I have started to experience some different things. You give someone counsel, and you watch them take that counsel, and their life improves. Maybe you preach a message, and you see it goes well, or you go soul winning, and you see a soul saved. And you begin to say, yeah, look at what, maybe it starts what God did through me, and then it might turn to say, look what I did for God. And we begin to take pride and to become prideful and glory in these different things that we have done. And so Paul said, hey, I've experienced more than y'all are ever going to experience, and I'm not glorying in this. So I would ask you, examine your own life and see, are we tempted to glory in some of these things? So what does he glory in? We're going to skip down a little bit and look at verse 7 and then verse 10. He says, unless I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. And look down in verse 10. He says, therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. So here's what I want to do for a second. I want to kind of look at each of these words. We're going to go on a little detour. We're going to look at each of these words just briefly, and then we're going to come back and bring it all together to finish out the passage in 2 Corinthians. Okay, so first off, would you go with me to John? John chapter 5. John chapter 5, and we'll be there in just a second. You know, when I was in college, I had a Dodge Dart. And I loved that car. You know, it was trying to be a sports car, but it wasn't sporty. It was trying to be like a grown-up adult car. It wasn't really that. It was somewhere right in between, you know. But I loved that car because I thought it looked sharp and because it was a manual. And I loved driving manual, okay. The car didn't give me too many problems until the very end. But at one point, it wouldn't start for me. And so there's a couple different things you can do to diagnose. I'm not a car guy, but I can handle tools and things. So I did my little diagnosis, and I determined, for sure, the starter on this car is bad. I need to change it. Now, I'm far away from home. I'm at college at this point, like 800 miles away from home, so I don't have all my dad's tools out in the shed I can just go grab. So I'm scrounging around the mechanical closet at this school that I'm at, and I find, you know, a ratchet, a couple of sockets in my pocket, and a YouTube video. And that's about all you need to change a starter, so it's fine. But I'm out here, I'm trying to figure out how to do it. It's not that complicated, but it was my first time, and it's in a car, it's cramped space, you know, trying to get under there, get in there, and turn all the bolts just right. Finally, I get the starter out. Now I have to do the process again in reverse to put the new starter in there. So I'm in there, I'm wrenching, I'm turning, I get it in there, plug everything in just right, everything is good to go. I get in the car, push the clutch down, put the key in, turn to start, nothing. Still didn't start. And I think to myself, are you kidding me? Advanced Auto sold me a defective starter. So I go into the car, I wrench and turn, I take that starter out, return it, get a new one, come back, get under there, wrench and turn again, put the new one in, get in the car again, push the clutch, turn the key, nothing. And at that point, I did what I should have done at the very beginning, which is to take your jumper cables, use your battery, and test the starter. And so I did that on the new one worked. I did it on the old one worked. The problem was never the starter. The problem, I'll just tell you, it was the clutch switch, which you don't have to take anything apart to get to. You don't have to crawl into the car. It's just a very small piece inside the car. My point of telling you that story is, if you ever need to change the starter, I'm your guy, all right? I have a lot of experience. No, my point of telling you that story is we can have a plan, we can put a lot of work into that plan, but if we have the wrong plan, if we have the wrong diagnosis, all of that work is fruitless and purposeless. So let's read just briefly here. I don't want to sit too long here, but John chapter 5, we have this man who is lame, and we'll start reading there at verse 5. And a certain man was there, which had an infirmity, 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he said unto him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" The impotent man answered him, "Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool, but while I am coming, another steppeth down before me." Jesus saith unto him, "Rise, take up thy bed, and walk." Okay, I jumped into the middle of that passage. I should give you some context. I'm sure most of you know. But there was a pool there that was believed to have healing properties. Now, at that time, they believed there was an angel that came down, and the first person to get in, whatever their trouble was, they would be immediately healed. Maybe that's the case. Personally, I think that it was a hot spring that was there, and it did give relief and healing to certain troubles and ailments. But it wasn't going to give lasting healing to a man who was lame. And so here's what I'm trying to say is that this man was lame. He had a plan. He said, "I can get rid of my disease, my lameness, by getting into this pool." He couldn't even accomplish his own plan because he was lame. Thirdly, if he were able to accomplish his own plan, it wouldn't have even worked for him. And so fourthly, Christ had to come and offer an alternative plan for him. So let's look at this story through two different lenses. First of all, through the lens of salvation. Maybe there's somebody here today and you're like that lame man because you're worried about your spiritual eternity, where your soul is going to go after you die. You know, there's a lot of plans out there that people have of how they can take care of that problem. But almost every plan has the same idea, and that is the problem of do. You got to get to the pool. You got to do something to get that plan to work, to relieve yourself of that ailment. Maybe it's some sort of good works. Maybe it's some sort of sacrifice. Maybe it's some sort of ego death or dismantling the ego. Whatever it is, it's something that you have to do. And so my question to you firstly would be, how are you doing on that plan? You know, you might look at yourself, you say, "Well, yeah, I have to do a bunch of good things and good works to get to heaven." How are you doing on that plan? Well, you can look around at the people next to you and say, "I'm doing pretty good compared to them." But God doesn't measure it that way. He measures it based on his standard of perfection, of holiness. Have you ever told a lie? Duh. We all have, right? Revelation says that all liars have their place in the lake of fire. I'm just saying God takes lying pretty seriously. We might have a plan to be good. We might think that plan will be good enough for us to take us to heaven. But we can't even measure up on our own plan. But thirdly, let me tell you something, that plan will never work even if we can accomplish the good things that we want. Even if we could always have victory over ourselves, even if we could always make ourselves sacrifice and do the things we want to do, that would never be good enough to satisfy God. And so, what we need is Christ, who came and offered us that alternate way. He died on a cross, living a perfect life, and he did two things. Well, he did a lot of things when he died on that cross. But first of all, he proclaimed victory over sin. And so that thing that was keeping you down, that was keeping you lame, that was keeping you from ever being able to enter heaven, he said, "I have victory and I have power over that." And secondly, not only was it keeping you from getting into heaven, it was damning you to hell and saying, "That is where you deserve to go." And he said, "I will take the penalty that is due you." And so he's saying, "Listen, you were deserving to go to hell. I will take that punishment. Not only will I take that punishment, but I will open the way for you to go to heaven." So there's no part of good works that can ever get you there. It's all of what Christ did. And so my question to you based on this passage is, what are you trusting in? What plan are you trying to follow to get you to heaven? Okay, let's look at this story through a different lens now, Christian. What about the idea of sin? Maybe we're struggling with some kind of sin, and we think, I have a plan that I can overcome this sin. Maybe the sin that you're struggling with is some kind of addiction that we recognize. Maybe you're struggling with drinking, and you want to get victory, and you set all these plans in place. Maybe it's smoking or gambling. That's becoming more popular, and it's accessible everywhere now. And you want to get free, and you don't want to do. Maybe it's pornography, and you say, "I'll never go back to this again." But time and time again, no matter what restrictions you set in place, no matter what plan you have, you can't accomplish that plan. But let me tell you something, you can't accomplish it, and even if you could, it won't set you free because you're doing it independent of Christ. And so just as Christ offers an alternate way to the unsaved person, just as he offered an alternate way to the man here at the Pool of Bethesda, he offers each and every one of us an alternate way. And he says, come to me. Let me offer that healing to you. And so now we're going to move on back to this passage in 2 Corinthians and keep looking at these words. But that word for the impotent man, that's that idea of infirmity. Okay, let's move on. Reproaches. Reproaches. This has the idea is somebody is out, I think, maybe to get your reputation. It's some slight against you or some conflict. Some, only by pride cometh contention. Some sort of contention that's going on there. And so it can be easy to get angry when somebody is out trying to trash your reputation. I think of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, you know. He was trying to do what was right. She came to him. He said no, and yet she besmirched his reputation, and he was sent to jail. But God was with him through the jail, and then God was with him to bring him out of the jail and to bring him to new heights. Okay, we'll move quickly here. Persecutions, things that we go through that we suffer for the name of Christ. You can maybe think of Paul and Silas. You can think of Paul many times put under persecution. And can we be tempted to be angry or upset? But we shouldn't be. We should turn to Christ and lean on him. But persecutions, different things we suffer. And we can think in our lives, you know, we got it pretty easy, but we still may suffer some persecutions. Somebody makes fun of you. Somebody expects you to, hey, why are you walking away when I'm telling the joke? That's dumb. You're dumb. You know, why are you? Whatever it is, we can suffer some form of persecution. But maybe someday in our lives, we'll suffer real persecution that will threaten our lives. There are plenty of Christians around the world who are suffering that. Paul, certainly when he wrote this, had been under that threat many times. And then distresses. This, as I understand it, has an idea of a narrow place. And so if I could say maybe an English expression would be, the walls are closing in, like a city that's under siege. And there's many things that this can apply to. Maybe you have some anxiety for all the things that are you feel responsible for. Maybe you're in college and it's getting to the end of the semester and all of the assignments are due and all of the bills are coming and everything feels like it's piling on top of you and you just are getting stressed out. The walls are closing in. Maybe it's some kind of grief and you've went through something hard and you just feel like I just can't escape this soul-crushing grief. It just feels like everything is just coming down on me. Or maybe it's some more global or nationwide, something you're anxious about. And if you're reading the news and if you're going down rabbit holes, you can become very stressed out of what's going on in our country and the world, and everything just feels like it's closing in. And that's that idea of distress. The walls are closing in. You're in a very narrow place. Those are the things that Paul says he glories in. Why does he glory in them? Well, let's read verses 9 and verse 10. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasures in infirmities and reproaches and necessities, in persecution and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. So let me just say three things up front, and then we'll unpack each one just a little bit. First of all, this is an ongoing process, not just a one-time event. Secondly, God's strength will be shown, but that doesn't always mean that the trial will be taken away. Thirdly, declaring our weakness will allow us to experience God's strength, to experience a full relationship with Him. So let's break each one of those down a little bit. First of all, this is an ongoing process, not a one-time event. You know, I think sometimes we think of a trial as a period of time where we'll have to lean upon God. We'll have to lean upon Christ. And we express it once at the beginning of the trial. We say, God, I need you. And then he helps us and he heals us and we're good again. That's not the idea. The idea is that we're always leaning on Christ. We're always recognizing our inability and we're always asking for his empowerment. It's a continuing event. He is continually making his strength real in us as we are continually acknowledging our weakness to him. Secondly, God's strength will be shown. That doesn't always mean that the trial will be taken away. You know, you ever read the original Grimm's Brothers fairy tale? Anyways, they're much darker if you've read them. They don't always have a happy ending. But when they get made into a children's book today or into a Disney movie or whatever form we see them today, they're always made happy and everything ends great. Even the stories that I told, I skipped over necessities. I forgot about that one. You can look at George Mueller and all the prayers that he prayed and all the needs that were met time and time again. But in each of those words that we looked at, there was some positive ending, right? The trial was taken away or the person was taken out of the trial. But that doesn't always happen in our life. And I fear that if we get that idea in our head, we'll claim this verse, the trial will stay in our life, and then we'll begin to blame God and say, so you're not holding true to your word? But God never promised to take us out of the trial or to take the trial away from us. He promises to give us strength in the trial, to be with us in the trial. Thirdly, declaring our weakness will allow us to experience God's strength, to experience a full relationship with Christ. Okay, let me try to tie all three of those together with a picture. I started to do it earlier a second ago. But I fear oftentimes we get this idea about the Christian life, and that is that God is over there, mature Christianity is over there, right? And we're walking the Christian walk. And so that is, we're by ourselves, we're self-sufficient, and we're walking towards Christ. And then perhaps a trial comes into our life and we become a little bit crippled. And so we have to pray and ask Christ to come to our side, and then he helps us for a little bit. The trial goes away, we get healed, and now we're good to go back on our way walking on our own again. But that's not the idea, because the Christian life, the posture of every Christian ought to be one of continual dependence, every moment of every day. And so what Paul is saying here is he's saying, I'm grateful for these trials, because they bring me to the end of myself when I can't do it anymore, and they force me into the position that I should be in at all times, one of dependence. And so he's saying, I'm grateful for this infirmity. There is some sin problem that you can't get victory over, and you try and you try and you try again, and you can't succeed. What are you forced to do? You're forced into a state of dependence. There's some rumor that's being spread about you, and it's spreading around, and you can try to fix it up, but that's just going to spread the mud around. Or you can be forced into a state of dependence. You have some need, and you're trying to work to earn enough money. You're doing all the math. The math just isn't adding up. What are you left to do? You're forced into a state of dependence. You have persecutions. You can turn your back on God, or you can be forced into a state of dependence. You have some distress. The world is closing in. Anxiety is taking you. You're having panic attacks, or you're having grief that you just feel you can never get free of. What can you do? You can be forced into a state of dependence. And once we're here, once we're dependent upon Christ, once we acknowledge our own weakness and inability, then we can experience Christ's strength. Like I said before, the strength doesn't automatically mean the problem is going to disappear. It may mean that you get to experience Christ strengthening your inner man, that we get to experience the comforting presence of Christ. And so I have for you this morning one encouragement and one challenge. First of all, I want you to see that Christ is able. We look at the story of the man at the pool of Bethesda. He had that infirmity, but Christ was able to heal him. We look at the story of Joseph. Christ was able to bring him out of the jail and set him and exalt him high. We can look at the story of George Mueller. He was able to have his needs met. Story after story, God is able and he is caring enough to hear your need when you cry out to him. He's worth running to. He's worth depending on in the trial and in every moment of life. He will not let you down. My challenge then this morning is a simple question. What is your position towards God right now? Is it one of self-sufficiency? Are we proud of the things we talked about in the first half? Maybe we our motives are fine. We're trying to serve God, but we're doing it in our own strength, and we're doing it on our own merit, and we're kind of proud about how we can do it so well. Or is it one of continual, not just pursuit of Christ, but also dependence upon him? And as a result, experiencing the strength and the power and the relationship with Christ. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you for this truth, that you are a God who cares, who can be depended on, and that only the pursuit of you and dependence upon you will lead to a full Christian life. You know, my questions for you are simple this morning, just exactly the same as my encouragement. And I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands. I'm just going to ask you to sit in your seat and talk to the Lord and thank Him for being strong and express your dependence upon Him. Maybe it's a renewed expression. Maybe you've stopped depending on Him. Or maybe you have been, and you can just continue to thank Him for that goodness. The piano's going to play. We're just going to sit and pray for a moment.